Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about her.
Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 227 of Her, the podcast, where you'll hear the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life, and today, deception in her intimate relationships. Oh boy, you heard me right. Yeah, this is going to be a first for a lot of you, and I really ask you to just take notes as we go along, because this is going to be an awesome podcast. So we have a great show coming up, and just know that it's made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Vitamins, the delicious once-a-day gummies that contain all of the essential vitamins, minerals, and omega oils customized just for women. Hop on over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com to learn more. And here's your first official reminder to click on to iTunes after this episode to rate and review the show. Why? Because I love hearing from you, and your feedback is absolutely golden for us. We love it. Okay, now it's time for her. I happen to know for a fact that just about every one of you have been hit with, one way or the other, personally or otherwise, the whole experience of deception in an intimate relationship. Yeah. You read about it all day long. Someone just, you know, finds out that something horrific has really been going on in the relationship all along. They never knew. Or they got taken advantage of from the get-go, and it goes on and on. So is there any solution to this? Is there any way to be able to find some way to resolve this, understand this? Is there some way to be able to help the victim? Well, thank heavens for this. We have a new book out there, and this is something you've got to pick up because you need to stay informed. And it's written beautifully, and it's written for you. It's called Intimate Lies and the Law. Intimate Lies and the Law. And this was written by Jill Elaine Hasday. She is Distinguished McKnight University Professor and the Centennial Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota Law School. Her work focuses on family law, anti-discrimination law, constitutional law, and legal history. She's a graduate of Yale Law School and Yale College and clerked for Judge Patricia Wald of the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. So, Jill, welcome to the Her Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
All right, now I'm going to open up with your closer. I couldn't put your book down. It just blew me away. I just sat there in complete learning mode because so many of us, you know, don't have this kind of experience as a lawyer, don't really understand how to be able to look at these kinds of issues when you look at deception in intimate relationships. And so here we go. I think this is beautiful. Deceit within intimate relationships is a persistent part of life and a consistent issue for the law. The legal rules, practices, and presumptions governing intimate deception have attracted little attention, remaining overlooked in the shadows rather than studied in the light. But this far-reaching body of law shapes both the everyday details and the overarching course of many lives, structuring people's decision-making, struggles, and opportunities. Intimate deception and the law governing it require much more critical scrutiny. The law of intimate deception is too important and needs too much reform to remain hidden in plain sight. Yeah, Jill, it was just beautifully written. And boy, if that...
Thank you.
No, seriously, if that doesn't hit you over the head with a hammer, I don't know what does. So I'm going to ask you some questions here so we can kind of wrap our heads around this. First of all, why did you write this book? Why was this important to you?
Well, I want to make clear at the outset that this did not come from my personal life. My dedication is to my loved ones. You did not inspire me to write this book. This came from the years I've spent teaching and writing family law. I would occasionally come across cases where a deceptive intimate inflicted enormous damage and got away with it because courts weren't willing to let the plaintiffs access the ordinary remedies the law usually makes available for deception in other contexts. And I just thought that was so interesting, and I always kept that in mind as something I wanted to explore.
I just love it, and I'm so glad you did. So, you know, let's kind of get into the weeds here. So why do people often assume that deception within intimate relationships is just kind of a private phenomenon and that courts and legislatures really don't apply?
I think, well, it's a ubiquitous phenomenon, and it's one of those things that is so common and so taken for granted that people don't focus their attention on it. But when you start to think about it, you realize the law responds to life. So if deception is a common phenomenon in intimate relationships, as it is, and I can talk more about that if you're interested, of course the law is always going to have to respond, even though deceived intimates generally don't fare well in the courts. They usually lose in court. Plenty of people still sue because their injuries are so enormous and they want to get recognition for them. So the law is constantly having to confront the issue. And what it normally does is it protects deceivers and it denies remedies to the people they deceived.
I mean, why is that? I mean, what I'd like to get into here a little bit are the presumptions on the part of the law. You know, it's sort of like it's a little shaming of the victim. It's like, were you that stupid? Didn't you see it? You know what I mean?
Yeah. So one theme you see in both courts and also just commentators, ordinary people, is they like to blame the person who was deceived. You should have investigated. You should have discovered. And there's this assumption that investigation would have been easy, would have uncovered the truth early on. I think it's not surprising that courts and commentators like to say it. Events tend to look more obvious in hindsight. Once we know the person turned out to be a deceiver, it seems so easy to spot the signs in retrospect. Also, it's comforting to believe that only the particularly stupid and gullible can fall for deception, because then we're safe since we're all so smart and savvy. But in fact, spotting deception is much more difficult than we'd like to believe, especially by an intimate. Even if you are suspicious, there's strong social norms encouraging us to trust our intimates rather than investigate. And even if you'd like to override those norms, it's difficult to investigate without the person finding out about it and it jeopardizing the relationship. So there's practical obstacles. If you search through someone's garbage or follow them, they may spot you. And there's legal obstacles. One irony is that courts tend to blame people for not investigating when the law itself makes investigation much more difficult. There are laws against searching through someone's emails or tax returns and credit reports for good reason. So I think there's this very understandable human tendency to want to blame people for being deceived, but it's just not fair. It's always easier in retrospect to say she should have known. One of the messages I want to say for the book is that if you have been deceived by an intimate, you're not alone and it's not your fault.
Ah, okay. All right. It's really interesting because I think an entire system is kind of rigged by a lot of judgments and presumptions. And I think that's what really makes it difficult for the victim themselves. What are some of the classic deceptions? You know, all these years you've done family law and back and forth. What are they? I could guess, but have you seen?
Okay, so people would ask me, you know, when I was writing this book, like, what kind of deception surprised you? At this point, nothing surprises me. Everything that people care about can be the subject of deception. So if you just go through the list of what people care about, finances, fidelity, do you have a criminal record, anything, it literally anything. If religion matters, people will lie about religion. It's literally anything that matters to someone in a relationship can be a source of deception. But I would say that sex and money tend to be huge sites of it, in part because those are things people care about.
Huh. Sex and money. Now, when you say sex and money, the money part I can kind of get. You take advantage of someone. Where's sex fit in? I mean, how does that work
in terms of deception? There's a million varieties, but a classic deception would be lying to someone so they'll agree to sleep with you when you know they wouldn't agree if you didn't lie. So maybe the most stereotypical example is pretending to be unmarried when you're actually married. And so some women actually have sued for battery. Basically, I was tricked into having sex because you lied to me about something very important, like you presented yourself as unmarried when in fact you were married. And ordinary tort law and battery says that battery is basically a harmful or offensive touching that I didn't consent to. And ordinary battery law says it doesn't count as consent if I was tricked into saying yes. So women have brought ordinary battery claims saying this person basically tricked me into having sex, and courts have been overwhelmingly unwilling to let them to access battery law, which is really the standard approach courts take. They say we have these ordinary remedies for deception. If you were deceived by an intimate, you can't access them. And also, courts tend to define intimacy very broadly in the sexual and romantic context. So in the example I gave you, the only reason they're intimates is because he's lying about his marital status, and they may not actually know each other very well. They probably don't actually. But the courts still treat them as intimates and say you can't access ordinary remedies.
Ha! You know, it makes you wonder, all right? Honestly, how well can someone vet the other person in the intimate relationship? I mean, what do you have to really do? You know, it's really interesting. There have been a lot of social media pieces and blogs out there about, hey, women, check out his economic status right off the bat. Is he even worth, you know, talking to? Does he have a job? You know, is he someone who's financially stable, et cetera, et cetera? So there's a little financial vetting going on. Not that it tells you all the answers to much of anything, but at least it gives you that. But really, when you sit back and you're thinking about getting involved in an intimate relationship, you know, a lot of people are sort of goo-goo odd, and they're like, you know, I'm just filled with, you know, such love or like for this person, and they let everything sort of fall by the wayside. So what do you think is something that would be reasonable to do to kind of protect yourself as you consider an intimate relationship?
Okay, so I guess I want to say two things. So first is, if you're feeling like you want to investigate, I'm not saying don't investigate. In the book, I have read many manuals by and for private detectives and skip tracers, and I go through what's available in the public records. I will say it might not be as comprehensive as you can imagine. So, for instance, criminal records, you have to do that for every jurisdiction. It's not like you can just press a button and investigate. But if you're thinking you'd like to investigate, I'm not discouraging you. Some people who've read my book have come back to me and said, after this, I'm going to investigate everyone. That said, I don't think people who don't investigate should be blamed for that. In general, the law wants us to trust. It wants us to form intimate relationships. They're good for people, and they're also good for society, right? It's a source of love and caregiving and cooperation. And I think it's unrealistic for courts to expect, oh, you started dating. Well, of course you would have run a complete dossier. That's just not our social norms, and it's not our expectations. That said, if you'd like to investigate, there are some, I talk about it in the book, there's some options available. One of my other ideas, in addition to giving people more remedies in court, I also want to make it easier to stop intimate deception before it happens. And so one of my ideas is, if someone wants to investigate, what are ways the law can change to facilitate that without jeopardizing privacy, liberty, or security? So one of my proposals is that states coordinate their public records on marriage, divorces, and bigamy convictions so that it is easier to actually find out whether someone is married or divorced than it is right now.
You know, it's so funny. We live in such a, you know, a novel new place where people, you know, swipe left or swipe right, and you kind of go in and out of some form of, I can't even call it a relationship. It's a hookup, a connection, something. And then there's all kinds of, you know, new variations on the theme of what an intimate relationship actually entails. It used to be a little bit more old school, you know, but now it's kind of all over the planet. And people are kind of freely coming in and out of relationships, maybe sometimes duping and taking advantage of people and then just sort of blowing out the exit door. It makes you wonder, whether or not because of that type of environment today, where the trust factor may be a little, you know, plus minus, whether or not this kind of vetting and investigating and doing, as it were, due diligence on someone really should become more of a standard operating procedure, as it were. What do you think?
Okay, so intimate deception is not, I first want to say intimate deception is not new. So right now people might deceive each other over the internet. I have cases in the book where people are deceiving each other using the Pony Express. Whatever technology you have can be a source, you know, a site that people use for intimate deception. Again, I think it's, if you want to investigate and you do investigate, more power to you. The question is, what should happen in the situation where you didn't investigate or your investigation didn't turn up the problem, right? Not every kind of deception is so easily found on a computer search. Many public records aren't even online now. What happens when you didn't investigate and you should have suffered injuries as a result? Should the person get away with it? In general, the law outside of intimacy has moved away from caveat emptor, which is buyer beware. In general, now if you sell a defective product or, you know, you lie in business, you're held liable for it. It's not the person's fault, oh, you should have investigated. And one of the pushes of the book is I want the law governing deception intimacy to be more like the law governing deception elsewhere. So if there's some remedy you could access elsewhere, you could have it here. I could actually give you an example.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Please, example.
Okay, so this woman named Paula Bonham, she connects with a man on a internet chat room. And over the course of almost 2 years, they exchange endless emails, phone calls, packages. She sends him more than $10,000 in gifts. And he puts her through the emotional wringer. He says he's dying of liver cancer. He's tried to commit suicide. Well, because the story's in my book, you know how it's going to end. He doesn't exist. She alleges that he's a fake persona invented by this woman named Jana St. James to manipulate her emotionally and financially. Paula sues Jana in Illinois for fraudulent misrepresentation, and her claim seems to fit into exactly what this legal claim is about. The defendant allegedly lied, wanted the plaintiff to rely on her lies. The plaintiff did reasonably rely, and she suffered injuries as a result. But the Illinois Supreme Court says Paula can't sue Jana for fraudulent misrepresentation because she was deceived by an intimate. So there's at least two things there that I really want to emphasize. The first is this bedrock idea, intimates can't access ordinary remedies for deception. Because it's intimate, you can't access this tort of fraudulent misrepresentation. But also it's the court's willingness to define intimacy so broadly to cover people who didn't even meet until right before the deception was unveiled. How could they? The whole scheme depended on avoiding face-to-face contact. So under my approach, Paula can present the same evidence and bring the same claim for fraudulent misrepresentation as anyone else. It doesn't matter whether the court classifies her, the defendant, as an intimate or not.
Huh. Interesting. So do you even need the word intimate? I mean, doesn't it
right,
kind
under
of
my
like,
approach,
you know?
Less matter. Right. So right now, courts tend to define intimacy very broadly in the romantic and sexual context, including many people who didn't know each other well or for long. And they actually define it pretty narrowly in the family context. So they'll count parents and children and spouses as intimates, but they'll treat sisters or cousins as strangers, as legal strangers. So, and I don't think either the broad or the narrow version of intimacy is fully defensible. So under my approach, much less turns on whether a court classifies a relationship as intimate, because it just doesn't matter. You have the same remedies.
I see. And that seems to, what it's doing is it's really, leveling the field and making it much more equal all the way across.
Right. So it's not like every deceived intimate who sues is going to win under my approach, but she can or he can access the ordinary law. You can try to prove your case. So in the Paula case I was just talking about, if she had been allowed to proceed, the whole case would turn on, did she reasonably rely or not? Because that's part of the existing legal standard. And Paula would have things to say, and Jana would have things to say in her defense, and it would just be like any other case. So it's not, under my approach, it's not like every deceived intimate wins. You still have to prove your case, but you're in the same position as any other plaintiff.
Is there any gender specificity to this? You know, are women more the victims? Are men more the victim? How does that work?
I think people have an assumption that intimate deception is something that men practice on women. And there's no systematic evidence to support that. My own sense is people from every demographic group are deceiving all the time. Women, though, do seem to make up a disproportionate amount of the plaintiffs, which could be in part that it's culturally easier for a woman to bring that suit than for a man to say he was deceived into sex by a woman. I think one reason this area hasn't gotten attention is that it is considered a women's claim, you know, sort of a messy women's claim. And there are some cases where the court's views about gender emerge very strongly. So, for instance, in some cases where women sue and their central claim is you tricked me into having sex by lying to me, the courts will say, will treat deception as like an essential part of heterosexual mating and even go so far as to suggest, like, how would the population survive if men weren't able to lie to get women into bed? You know, so that's a very gendered statement.
Ouch!
You don't always see it that sharply. But so I think gender does run through these cases.
Yeah. And this is why I keep coming back to this. It's like a cultural underpinning of judgments, presumptions, sexism. It just goes on and on. And I think that that's one of the things that really is forming, you know, the bumpy road here to be able to achieve your goal of more equal treatment under the law. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted you to bring that up, because I think this is a very messy problem that, as you said in your conclusion, just has not been given anywhere near the level of scrutiny. But now we live in a Me Too age, and I think a lot of these issues are starting to surface. I mean, look, how many times do you open up a magazine or newspaper or whatever, and you see yet another headline that says somebody who's famous finds out that they've been duped by their spouse or partner in a major way? How many times do you know that? And then you sit back and say, wow, you know, how did that person allow that to happen, or back and forth and up and down? Go ahead, please.
No, I mean, I think you're totally right that the way the law changes, the best way the law changes is for more people to start thinking and talking about the subject, for it to go from in the background where we know this happens to really think about what are the injuries that can be inflicted, which can be enormous, financial injuries, illnesses, violations of sexual autonomy, lost time, missed opportunity, obviously emotional distress, but for people to think more systematically about what happens and how should the law respond, I think is really the first step. And the other thing I'll say is, having talked to a lot of people as I've been writing this book, many smart people, many sophisticated people, many people with resources can fall for intimate deception. The intimates are people you trust. We tend to be overly confident, so that we're so convinced that we would know if an intimate is lying that it's actually easier to be fooled. Because when your alarm bells don't go off, you think, oh, that must be, I would have detected if there was anything wrong.
Would you also include people who take advantage of aging parents, grandparents, whomever, and rob their bank accounts and,
do
that whole thing?
The book is also, in addition to being about romantic and sexual relationships, is also about family relationships, parents, children, etc. Courts in general, it's interesting in the parent-child context, courts are very protective of parents who deceive their children, but they're very willing to go after children who deceive their parents, which I find interesting, whether or not the parents are particularly elderly or vulnerable. So it's a little uneven. But I agree, I could have actually written the entire book about deceiving elderly parents. I mean, there's so many different areas. What I was trying to do in this book is to show here there's a million different varieties of intimate deception, and you can see themes in how the law operates.
Yeah, and also you can see prejudice and bias, because if I brought up that issue of the parent and grandparent thing for a reason, and that is now you switch your channel in your brain from, she's someone who really should have known what was coming her way, to, oh my gosh, a poor, vulnerable, innocent individual, an older person or whomever is getting robbed of this, maybe it's someone who's ill or back and forth, and this is a heinous situation. So we should go after that, you know, rotten, you know, duper, that person who's, you know, put forth this kind of a problem. I just think that it's a different mindset, I would think, on the part of the court. What do you think?
I think that's true. I mean, in general, the law uses the fact that you prayed, even so. I want to contest the idea that people who fall for deception are particularly gullible, because I don't think that's right. But even if they are, the law usually uses the fact that you prey on someone who's particularly gullible and vulnerable as a reason to go after you. You terrible, like, think about someone who calls and tries to get credit card numbers over the phone. Of course, the people who give them are particularly credulous, right? The law, the
right.
People who are less savvy are who need more help from the law. That's just a sort of by definition. But generally, the fact that you prayed on the weak is a strike against you, not your exoneration. And it's different in the intimate context. But courts have a very, at least in the romantic and sexual context, when I started the book, I thought, oh, maybe courts will deny a remedy for intimate deception because they just think this is too unimportant and it's just not worth their time. But in fact, courts write as if preserving intimate deception is crucially important, and they're committed to preserving what they see as ordinary deception in relationships, which is just remarkable, especially because what they define as ordinary deception can be very far-ranging. So lying about a pregnancy, even after it helps trigger the suicide of the man's wife, ordinary deception, no remedy. Lying to conceal that you already have two children, ordinary deception, no remedy. Lying to conceal that you're unable to work full-time. Ordinary deception, no remedy. I mean, courts just are normatively, you know, as a matter of value judgments, committed to this idea that we're going to leave deception intact in intimate relationships, but they never quite explain why. You know, what's the value there?
I just love this. Everyone, we've been talking to Jill Elaine Hasday. She is the author of Intimate Lies and the Law, and the subtitle is Governing Deception in Our Closest Relationships. I have just found this book to be superb. It's a beautiful read, and wow, you're going to have some eye-opening awakenings in here, and all of us really need to be informed. So grab Intimate Lies and the Law. Jill, thank you so much for being on the Herb Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. And if people are interested in more information about the book, they can find it at jillhasday.com.
Excellent. Fantastic. Okay, now everyone, right now, come on. This is your second official reminder. Hit iTunes and rate and review this show because I want to hear from you. This was an eye-opener. Oh my gosh, so many questions. Love it. Grab the book. I'm Dr. Pam Peek, host of the Herb Podcast. Follow me on Facebook at Dr. Pam Peek or Twitter at Pam Peek MD. And remember to catch every single episode of the Herb Podcast on iTunes or Radio MD. Thanks so much for listening and stay well.